I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have state cooperation with the Central African Republic. We will continue it. It is supported by the necessary agreements, and of course, our military advisors will continue their activities in the necessary and demanded quantity.
After the Wagner Group's aborted mutiny in Russia, the Biden administration's imposed new sanctions on companies accused of profiting from the activities of the Wagner Group in Africa. This comes as Russian military police raided Wagner mercenary bases in Syria. We'll get an update. Then, the impact of the climate crisis is being felt in the United States from the Midwest to the East Coast as millions face record heat and horrible air quality from smoke unleashed by wildfires raging in Canada. The media does a great job covering the smoke. But what about the fire? What's causing it? We'll look at the role of fossil fuel companies and calls for the media to end climate silence. And we go to Montana to a youth-led climate trial just ended after 5 days of dramatic testimony on who can be held responsible for the climate crisis.
I joined this case out of love for Montana because I grew up here. I've spent my life here, and it's a beautiful place to call home. And so I am a plaintiff in, you know, in hopes of protecting my constitutional rights and creating a future where I can be confident in a clean environment, a healthful life for myself and my descendants. And so after participating in trial, I'm excited to see what the outcome of this case
is. We'll speak with one of the teenagers who sued Montana. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Smoke from nearly 500 wildfires in Canada is blanketing much of North America in an unprecedented haze, triggering air quality alerts in 20 U.S. states that are home to a third of the population. On Wednesday, the EPA's air quality index for major cities, including Chicago, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Milwaukee, Pittsburgh, and Toronto, reached unhealthy or very unhealthy levels as city skylines faded into a shroud of smoky air. Air pollution near Detroit reached hazardous levels. Meanwhile, over 100 million people across the United States are under heat warnings and watches today as a heat dome that's lingered over Texas expands to southeastern states and parts of California brace for triple-digit temperatures. We'll have the latest on Canada's wildfires and the climate crisis later in the broadcast. In Sudan, heavy fighting's resumed around the capital, Khartoum, despite declared ceasefires marking the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. Fighting between Sudan's army and the rival Rapid Support Forces is heaviest in Sudan's most populous city, Omdurman, where residents report airstrikes and fierce anti-aircraft fire in civilian-populated areas. The UN says 10 weeks of heavy clashes in Sudan and ethnically motivated killings in the western region of Darfur have displaced nearly 2.8 million people. In France, anger over the police killing of a 17-year-old boiled over into protests for a second straight night in over a dozen cities. Protesters set fire to cars, trash cans, police stations, and launched fireworks at officers who responded with volleys of tear gas. France's interior minister said 150 people have been arrested. Some 2,000 riot police were called up in suburbs around Paris, including in Nanterre, where the teen, who's been identified only by the name Nahel M, was shot dead Tuesday after he was pulled over for allegedly breaking traffic rules. Video posted on social media contradicts the claims of police who initially reported one officer shot the teen for driving his car directly at them. Instead, the video shows two officers standing beside the vehicle. One of them points a gun as a voice is heard saying, "You're going to get a bullet in the head." The officer then fires at close range as the boy drives off. French President Emmanuel Macron called the teen's killing unexplainable and inexcusable. Macron also said the resulting protests were, quote, absolutely unjustifiable. French Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne condemned the actions of officers.
The shocking images broadcast yesterday show an intervention that clearly does not seem to comply with the rules of engagement of our law enforcement officers.
The UN Security Council has called for restraint on all sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict amid surging violence in the occupied West Bank. On Tuesday, U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the United Nations Robert Wood offered a rare diplomatic rebuke of Israel over the demolition of Palestinian homes and the incitement to violence by elected officials in Israel.
We are also deeply troubled by Israel's recent announcements advancing more than 5,000 settlement units and reports of changes to Israel's system of settlement administration that expedite the planning and approval of settlements.
The U.S. Navy says it will station its largest nuclear-armed submarine in South Korea for the first time in four decades. This comes after the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol and President Joe Biden agreed to a deal in April in which South Korea agreed not to develop its own nuclear weapons in exchange for a more aggressive U.S. nuclear posture toward North Korea. President Joe Biden's holding a pair of fundraisers with wealthy donors in New York today ahead of the Federal Election Commission's June 30th disclosure deadline. On Wednesday, Biden flew to Chicago for a fundraiser with deep-pocketed Democratic donors at the home of Illinois' billionaire governor, J.B. Pritzker. Biden also used his Chicago trip to tout his administration's handling of the U.S. economy, embracing the label Bidenomics as a brand for his 2024 reelection campaign. Back in the United States, several sheriff's deputies in Rankin County, Mississippi, have been fired after two black men filed a lawsuit alleging torture and attempted sexual assault by officers. Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker say six deputies entered their home outside Jackson in January and handcuffed, kicked, and waterboarded them, taunted them with racist slurs, attempted sexual assault, and repeatedly electrocuted them with tasers. Jenkins says one deputy placed a gun into his mouth and pulled the trigger, lacerating his tongue and shattering his jaw. The men are seeking $400 million in damages from Rankin County Sheriff Brian Bailey and six deputies. The FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division have opened investigations. Here in New York, a white former U.S. Marine who choked black street performer Jordan Neely to death on a subway train has pleaded not guilty to charges of second-degree manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. Daniel Penny entered the plea at his arraignment in Manhattan court Wednesday before walking free on $100,000 bail. His next court appearance is October 25th. A legal defense fund set up by Penny's lawyers has raised nearly $3 million. Speaking outside the courthouse after Penny's arraignment, Neely family lawyer Dante Mills promised justice.
Daniel Penny killed a man. He took a life. And for everyone who thought donating $3 million would somehow make this go away or buy his pass, it's not going to happen. It didn't work. You can ask for a refund. We're here. Help is here. So from now on, when justice happens, don't be surprised and don't be shocked.
The Biden administration's dropped its civil rights investigation into whether air pollution regulators discriminated against black communities in an industrial section of Louisiana known as Cancer Alley. Some 200 petrochemical plants span the majority black region over an 80-mile stretch of the Mississippi River. On Tuesday, the Environmental Protection Agency said in a court filing it had uncovered no finding of discrimination or other violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's despite initial findings that Louisiana environmental and health officials failed to provide accurate information to residents about airborne emissions of chloroprene, a hazardous chemical linked to lung and liver cancer. The Belgian chemical company Solvay has agreed to pay nearly $400 million to settle claims linked to drinking water contamination near its factory in southern New Jersey. The funds will be used to clean up pollution caused by PFAS, a class of toxic substances commonly called forever chemicals that don't break down in the environment or in the human body. PFAS have been linked to cancer, liver and thyroid disease, maternal mortality, birth defects and other health problems. Wednesday's settlement comes a week after 3M agreed to pay more than $10 billion to settle lawsuits claiming it knowingly used forever chemicals in its products despite risks to human health. This comes as Republican Congress members are promoting legislation that would weaken attempts to regulate PFAS while insulating many polluters from liability under the federal Superfund law. The United States has recorded its first cases of domestically transmitted malaria for the first time in two decades. Dr. Deborah Howry, the chief medical officer at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, said Tuesday the mosquito-borne disease was discovered in four people from Florida and one person in Texas.
So it's a concern because malaria is a life-threatening disease. It's not often seen in the United States, and we hadn't seen it domestically acquired in over 20 years.
In 2021, malaria infected nearly a quarter billion people, killing more than 600,000 of them around the world. The disease is triggered by a parasite that's spread to humans by certain types of mosquitoes that thrive in warm weather and humid conditions. In recent years, those mosquitoes have expanded their ranges in ways that are consistent with climate change. And the head of the Teamsters Union says a third of a million workers at UPS will likely walk off the job August 1st after slamming the shipping company's proposed union contract as appalling. Teamsters President Sean M. O'Brien said in a statement, quote, "The largest single employer strike in American history now appears inevitable. Executives at UPS, some of whom get tens of millions of dollars a year, do not care about the hundreds of thousands of American workers who make this company run," he said. The Teamsters are demanding UPS exchange its last, best, and final offer no later than Friday. Earlier this month, 97% of unionized UPS workers voted to authorize a nationwide strike if managers don't agree to a new union contract by July 31st. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
A top Russian general has reportedly been arrested amidst a crackdown on military officials with close ties to the Wagner mercenary group. General Sergei Surovikin was known to have a good relationship with Yevgeny Prigozhin, who led Wagner's aborted mutiny last weekend. Surovikin was nicknamed General Armageddon because of his bombardment tactics in the Syrian conflict. He's not been seen since Saturday's armed revolt. The Moscow Times quoted a source saying apparently he, Surovikin, chose Prigozhin's side during the uprising. Meanwhile, in Belarus, where Wagner group leader Prigozhin is apparently now exiled, the New York Times is reporting on construction of a new military base for Wagner fighters who were given the option of relocating to Belarus after the group's failed uprising. Satellite images by Planet Labs show the construction about 80 miles from the Belarusian capital of Minsk and about 13 miles from a town with multiple military facilities. This comes as the Biden administration's imposed a new sanctions on companies accused of profiting from the activities of the Wagner group in Africa. The Treasury Department says the sanctions will punish four companies based in Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and the Central African Republic that extract gold, diamonds, and other minerals to help fund the mercenary force. The sanctions were announced after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Monday Wagner mercenaries will not be withdrawn from Africa following last weekend's mutiny. Saudi news outlets are reporting Russian military police in Syria conducted raids on Wagner mercenary bases in Syria and arrested the head of the Wagner group in southern Syria. On Wednesday, a Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said leaders in Africa would decide whether Wagner forces will continue to work in their countries.
Whether Wagner forces continue on in African countries, whether they continue to work under contracts and stay there, depends on the sovereign authorities of the African countries.
For more, we're joined by Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. She's been working on the Wagner group for years. Professor Martin, it's great to have you back with us. If you can explain, you have the Wagner group's aborted mutiny in Russia. This is followed by the United States saying they're imposing these sanctions on the group that's opposing President Putin, right, the Wagner Group, whose leader, known as Putin's chef, Prigozhin, was formerly very close to Putin. But imposing sanctions on the group, companies that are profiting from Wagner in Africa, from Mali to Central African Republic, and then we have Syria. Please explain how the Wagner Group operates and what is the U.S.'s interest in cracking down on the group that's rising up against Putin, who's waging the war in Ukraine.
Well, thanks for having me back. This isn't the first time, certainly, that the United States has imposed sanctions against the Wagner Group or against Yevgeny Prigozhin. Remember, it was very clear from the Mueller indictments that Prigozhin was responsible with his internet research agency based in St. Petersburg for election interference in the United States. And so this is just another in a stream of sanctions that have been placed against Prigozhin-affiliated organizations. And I think what's most significant about these sanctions is not the ones that are on the groups that are based in Russia or that are based in the Central African Republic, because they're unlikely to have any dealings with the United States or with the U.S. allies in any case. The most significant is the sanction that was put against a firm located in the United Arab Emirates. It has been known for a couple of years with very well documented evidence in open source locations like the New York Times, that Dubai has been a place where Russia could take the gold, in particular, that it is mining in Africa, send it for melting down in the UAE, and then get the cash for it into Russia at a time when Russia is under sanctions and isn't supposed to be engaged in the gold trade. And in May, the UAE came out with a statement that said, of course, we will continue to trade openly with our partners under UN mandates. Well, the United Nations Security Council does not have sanctions against Russia because, of course, Russia has veto power in the United Nations Security Council. And so in essence, that statement that was made in May by the United Arab Emirates was saying, we don't follow U.S. sanctions. And I think the significance of what happened in the last couple of days is the United States was saying that the UAE is not exempt from feeling the power of U.S. economic sanctions. And that matters because the UAE has a traditional strong defense relationship with the United States, but kind of an odd one because the UAE also has a strong defense relationship with Russia.
So, Professor Martin, if you could talk about some of these companies that Wagner has been involved with or actively running. They're all over Africa, certainly, and also elsewhere. The Wall Street Journal, in fact, in a recent documentary, found that there were 64 companies, some of them shell companies, linked to Wagner, and also linked Wagner to the Kremlin. Could you explain what we know about these companies and where all they operate?
Sure. I think it's important to keep in mind that when we're talking about these links, Wagner itself does not exist as an entity. The Wagner Group is a contracting mechanism for the Russian military intelligence agency. So the key person in all of this is actually Yevgeny Prigozhin. He's the person who does the contracting for Wagner Group activities, or has up until this point. And he is also the person who is associated with all of these various companies. He and his personnel have been linked to what all of these companies have been doing. I think it's really important to keep in mind that in Russia, we don't have any form of protection of private property rights, and that Prigozhin was in charge of these companies primarily not because he is some oligarch who has all kinds of economic talents and business talents and did this on his own. He was taking this role because of a patron-client relationship that he has with Vladimir Putin, which extends back to the early 1990s in St. Petersburg. And he was there on the behest of the Kremlin. So now that we see that things are happening with Prigozhin, we're not exactly sure what they may be. Nobody has seen him since Saturday. There are rumors in the Russian social media sphere that he has been told to get out of Russia and to liquidate all his business holdings by July 1st. We'll see if that actually happens. One thing to keep in mind is that it would be really easy for the Kremlin to just has put in place some other individual as the titular CEO of all these various companies. So no matter what happens to Prigozhin, I think it's very unlikely that it's going to affect Russia's presence in Africa, which has been built up very strongly since 2014, since the sanctions originally went into effect against Russia for its initial incursions into eastern Ukraine and Crimea. Even though the statement came in your top of the hour quoting of Lavrov saying that the African sovereign countries are going to be able to make their own decisions, we know from a report that came out just in the last couple of days confirming things that the Wagner Group has essentially taken over sovereign control in much of the Central African Republic. And there's no way in the world that Russia is going to be leaving there, no matter what happens to Prigozhin, no matter what happens to the people who have been under this heading called the Wagner Group, who are essentially just contractors for the Russian defense ministry and the Russian military intelligence agency in one form or another.
Professor Martin, do we have any idea of what kind of money, what kind of resources are involved here? I mean, when the Wagner Group was operating in Syria, they were tasked, of course, principally with defending the Assad regime. But one of their tasks was to defend, and they captured, four of the largest oil fields in Syria in exchange for protecting the oil fields. They were given 25% of the production value from the fields. There are similar things being said about the role that they've played with gold mines in the Central African Republic. So what kinds of, like, how much money are we talking about? Like hundreds of millions, billions of dollars?
Yeah. Nobody knows for sure, but let me just talk about some of the examples that you raised. In Syria, we have to keep in mind that Syria has never been a really major player in the world in terms of being an oil and gas producer. Russia is a very major player in terms of being an oil and gas producer and having other kinds of economic relationships with other countries who are major oil and gas producers. And so the significance of the Prigozhin takeover, the Wagner Group takeover of those oil and gas assets in Syria, I think most experts believe is less in terms of their actual economic value to Russia or to Prigozhin, and more that it allowed Russia to establish a permanent economic presence in Syria, no matter what happens now that the war has been winding down over the last couple of years. And in particular, their presence in those oil and gas areas have prevented Hezbollah as a representative of the Iranian government, the Iranian regime, from having the ability to have oil and gas lines that transmit from Iran to Lebanon through Syria in a way that would give Iran a dominating presence over the oil and gas, especially the gas transmission lines in the Middle East. And so there's been geopolitics involved here, I think, much more than the importance of the funding has been for the Russian government in terms of what's happened in Syria. In the Central African Republic, most of the mines, both the gold mines and the diamond mines, are artisanal. And that means that the presence of the resources is very much on the surface of the land. And so you have people sitting there with shovels and pails and sieves trying to get little pieces of minerals from these mines. For the individuals involved in the actual mining, of course, it can be a just incredible find for them because they're coming from a very impoverished background. But again, for Russia, Russia has huge gold and diamond reserves of its own, huge gold and diamond reserves in various places around the world. So the monetary value of most of these mines is not very high in terms of their relative value for Russia. The one exception to this is the Namasima mine that is the one where the Wagner Group has been seen as really turning it from a artisanal mine, a surface level mine, into an industrial quality gold mine. As far as we know, that is not yet a finished process. And so the Wagner Group has not yet been getting industrial quality gold to the extent that it would have been, that Russia would have been getting industrial quality quantities and qualities of gold from other deposits that it has access to. But that is the mine that has now come under the U.S. sanctions. And that is the one where Wagner had the best chance of actually making significant money. But again, there's no evidence that it is already getting significant money from these things. And so it's more establishing a presence, perhaps getting some funding around the edges. But what we have seen is that the major funding that is going into the Wagner Group has either, in the case of its activities in Ukraine, come directly from the Russian government, which is something that Putin himself said on Monday in a rather remarkable admission, or from the contracts that it has with government officials in all of these foreign countries, in Syria, in Libya, not in the government in Libya, but in the warlord in eastern Libya, Khalifa Haftar, in Mali, in the Central African Republic, contracts that have all been done with the support of Russian diplomatic groups, with Russian ministries like the energy ministry, but that are contracts for the Wagner Group to fulfill its duties there, rather than, in most cases, getting a great deal of money from the minerals that are actually coming out.
Professor Martin, I wanted to ask you about the human toll. We're talking about the money made from mining. But these very places that you're talking about, that the world media rarely covers when it comes to the enormous death toll, we're talking about the Central African Republic, we're talking about Mali, we're talking about Sudan. What is the role of the Wagner groups in these conflicts?
So we know in Sudan that when the original democracy movement had been starting there, when there was a series of coups that were going on in Sudan, we know that the Wagner Group was at least giving advisory assistance to the Sudanese military government to try to put down the protesters violently. It's not clear that the Wagner Group per se has a security role right now that is significant in Sudan. We know that they're still engaged, that Prigozhin's interests are still engaged in gold mining in Sudan. But right now, it's not clear that there's a continuing Wagner military presence in Sudan. In both the Central African Republic and in Mali, we know that the Wagner Group has been credibly accused of engaging in real atrocities, in massacres of civilians, in torture and in rape, alongside the domestic security forces of both the Central African Republic and the Mali junta that is now in charge, and that also fits what we know about what the Wagner Group has done in Ukraine, where it has also been, in that case, by the United Nations, sort of indicted for the role that it has played in the torture and murder alongside regular Russian military forces of civilians, especially in eastern Ukraine. And so we know that it is a horrific group. We know that it engaged in atrocities against civilians also in Libya during the time that the warlord, Khalifa Haftar was attempting to make his move towards Tripoli and to capture Tripoli. He failed. But we know that the Wagner Group left behind mines and improvised explosive devices in civilian areas, in homes when it was withdrawing. So it just has an absolutely horrible record of committing civilian atrocities. And I would just remind us all that that makes it not much different from the Russian uniformed military forces. Sometimes people almost make a distinction between what the Wagner Group has been doing and what the uniformed Russian military has doing. But in places ranging from Afghanistan under Soviet times, in Chechnya, in Syria, and now in Ukraine, we see the Russian uniformed forces doing things that are very similar to what Wagner forces are doing. And of course, most of the Wagner forces, many of them at least, are former Russian uniformed military officers. They're veterans from Russia.
Finally, Professor Martin, if you could say what we know at the moment of Prigozhin's whereabouts, as well as many or some of Wagner's mercenaries. There, of course, the assumption is that he's now in Belarus, but you have said that, in fact, very, very little satellite imagery exists that could show one way or another if they are there. The BBC World Service this morning reported that some flight tracker data has shown that his private jet went into Belarus, but then was shown leaving the following day and returning to his hometown in Russia. What do we know of where he is and what the status? I mean, is Wagner now, to the extent that it exists as an entity, going to be disbanded as a result of this?
We have no idea. The truth is that Prigozhin has not been seen since Saturday night when he left Rostov. He issued an audio statement on Sunday, but it's not clear when that audio statement was actually recorded. And there has been no sighting of him since then. So President Lukashenko of Belarus says that he is in Belarus, but we don't know. Again, there was this statement that came across on a Russian military-associated social media site indicating that he has until July 1st to leave Russia, but we don't know. We don't know who was on his plane as it went back and forth.